Welcome to the Talking Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I'm Kevin Lee. Donald Davidson is here, the historian of the world's most famous racetrack. It is race weekend at Indianapolis. Race E for NASCAR Xfinity coming up late tomorrow afternoon. 1070 The Fan's coverage starts tomorrow 10 a.m. with Bruno and the Blue Mare, the producers. We'll be here tomorrow from 11:30 until 1 from the Pagoda Plaza, qualifying for the Sprint Cup race at 1 o'clock. And that takes us until 7 o'clock. So we'll have qualifying, and then we'll have the Xfinity Series. And then Brett McMillan and I will host the post-race show here exclusively on 1070 The Fan and FM 107.5 from about 6-ish until 7 tomorrow. And then Sunday, the fun starts again. What time on Sunday morning? I'm going to say 10-ish. 10-ish? Whenever JMV feels like coming in is when we'll start on Sunday morning, and that will roll up until the green flag at about 3:45 on Sunday, and we'll be back here for post-race coverage on Sunday evening as well. 317-239-1070 is the telephone number. Before we begin, Donald, I want to continue what Kurt and I were talking about in the last hour, and you offered something during the break about the significance of this event.
Yeah.
To NASCAR.
Yeah.
And what you told me, I think, was very interesting.
Well, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. It was something I was writing for the program, and it must have been a Brickyard 400 program. But anyway, I had called Bill France Jr., Billy France, but Bill France Jr., to see if I could talk with him. And he actually came out of a board meeting to take the call. And I said, oh, you know, this. I didn't want to disturb you. He said, no, that's all right. And I told him that I was writing a piece for the program, and that his impression of, you know, the first Brickyard 400. And he said something like, when we came out onto the bricks shortly before the start, and we did the photograph with the lineup with the 43 drivers, plus I think there were three IMS officials and three NASCAR officials. It was Mrs. Holman, Mary Holman, and Tony George, and then Bill France Jr. and Les Richter and Mike Helton. Anyway, he said when we lined up for that photograph, he said, I felt that that was the defining moment in NASCAR. He said, we've arrived. The grandstands are full, and we're at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to do a NASCAR race. And he said, I felt that that was probably our most defining moment.
And most significant, too, and we've talked about it before, there were some other notable events in NASCAR's history, but, yeah, this certainly had a lot to do with it, and it still matters today. You know, and this event is what started the change of where they race, going to places like Chicagoland and Kansas and out of the Southeast. And, you know, I'm sure some of the long-time hardcore fan base, we all lament the good old days. We all think about what it was like when we first became attracted to something, especially when it comes to a sport. And there are some that might miss that, but from a business standpoint, obviously, it worked out pretty well for them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I know I've spoken about this many times, and I think in recent years, now the young drivers come up, and probably the Brickyard 400 was already running by the time they were aware of motor racing.
Yeah.
And so I'm not saying that they come in here with no appreciation, but it was not quite...
That's a good point.
The really warming thing to me was in 1994-95, and you had several of the old, you know, the old line NASCAR regulars. I remember Jimmy Hensley in particular, and Morgan Shepherd, and people like that. And they just couldn't believe that they were here. They said, you know, when we were kids, you know, we thought Indianapolis 500, and then, you know, we realized
we're never going to get to go there.
And we just cannot believe that we were here. And it was really interesting to, during the next 2 or 3 years, to meet some of them and find that Indianapolis was so important to them. I mean, I got a lot of surprises. For instance, Jimmy Spencer, his favorite driver, his hero, was Mark Donahue. He used to go to the Pocono 500 when he was a teenager. And so there were many stories like that. I remember Jody Ridley was a driver that his favorite driver was Parnelli Jones, and his favorite car was the 1963 500 winner. And that's why he always used 98 on his stock cars. So there was a lot of things like that. But I just remember how special that was. As I say, I keep singling out Jimmy Hensley. There was a dozen, yeah, you know, or 10 or so. And they were asking A.J. Foyt, would you pose with me for a photograph standing on the bricks? Because it was just the ultimate pinch me moment for them to be here.
Mike J at Tunnelhead1 on Twitter says, tell Donald that Jeff Burton talked about how the Wood Brothers revolutionized pit stops in Indy the NBC broadcast today.
Oh, I got to find Jeff Burton, who's a very nice guy, and talk to him. In fact, somebody sent me a link that Ford just put out a story that actually wasn't too bad about how they revolutionized the pit stops. And the one thing that I thought, oh, my goodness, was that one of the Wood Brothers actually said, we did pit stops in under 20 seconds. Not according to the records that I have. Jim Clark's first pit stop in 65 was 21,
yeah, 20-ish.
And 25. but they didn't quite compare with, in 1960, A.J. Watson and his crew, two of their three pit stops were 19 seconds with three wheel changes in addition to fuel. And when the Wood Brothers pitted Jim Clark, they never changed a wheel because the tires went the whole distance. So I'll have to find Jeff Burton. And
were the Wood Brothers then just the most successful at marketing pit stops?
Oh, no. But, the Wood Brothers really never made the claims.
Yeah,
it's just
it was
the stories
it was
growing
others.
Legs over the years. And a colleague of Jeff Burton was the one that really laid it on thick.
A colleague of Jeff Burton.
Owensboro, Kentucky. But that's okay.
Oh, okay. A colleague at another network.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
in the same business.
I met a colleague on the track rather than of the broadcast booth, although, yeah, well,
yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. One more thing before we get to telephone calls. Going back from the story yesterday, was it yesterday or the day before? You were talking about with Lem Trotter and the rock across the street. Remind me again, the picture that we have seen, is it called The Vision?
The Vision, yes.
Where it's, it's an iconic picture, and a lot of people think it's Carl Fisher, and it's not. Is it Louis Strang?
Louis Strang,
who was one of the top drivers in the 1907, 1908 range, and he raced here at the Speedway in the early years. So there's that picture of a model that's probably, a couple of yards big.
Yeah,
he's staring at
it.
Was that over here by Georgetown? Where was that on the grounds?
That was to the east, and it's approximately where the Speedway Motel parking lot is. It's just next to the house. We think approximately looking at the barn, and 16th Street. There was no 16th Street. It was the Crawfordsville Pike.
Yeah,
the Crawfordsville Pike, which went down to what used to be the corner of 16th and Georgetown, and then angled out along to go parallel with where the railway tracks were. There was no town of Speedway yet.
Mm-hmm.
This was all farmland out here, and when the track, in fact, they would not actually have started yet, because that picture was taken, I think we figured out the date was March the 11th of 1909.
Okay.
And they kept saying, work is going to begin at once. But I don't think they actually started until a little later after. They may have done some grading. But anyway, Louis Strang drove for Buick when the factories were racing to try and get publicity for what they were selling to the public. And he happened to be coming through town, and they bought him out for a photo op. And there's actually two or three different versions of that shot. And I think one he's down with his hands on his knees, and another one he's standing up straight. But basically, they put that out there. It would be more than a couple of yards. It's a little bigger than that.
Okay.
But basically, they just put it out to show the locals, this is what we're doing here.
Yeah, just a scale model. You see that for sporting stadiums all the time. When the Colts are going to build a new stadium, you see, I remember when they were building Lucas Oil Stadium in the offices, they had the scale model when they were still playing at the RCA Dome. So it's fascinating. Funny, you know, that would be something, too, that you'd love to see a marker over there for something like that. I don't know that that quite takes to historical significance because it's not as if anything momentous happened at that spot, but it's still the photo that so many of us correlate with the image and the design and the beginnings of this track.
But I'm so glad the person called last night because I've had several people mention The Rock today.
Yeah, me too.
And you know, hopefully that could go back to within a few feet of where it was. But that, as I said, was based on the fact that Lem Trotter was still alive till 1966, and he showed his pals, this is where Fisher and I stood and said, this property's for sale across the street.
I love the old stories about the beginnings. That's I assume you still do that in your class
on
the first night? That's
sure.
You know, we love the free form, but you know that you're going to get that. Just tell me how this all came together, and that's if you've never taken Donald's class before, that is always a part of it. Are you doing one in the fall again this year?
Yes, I am.
What's the best place? I always get this question. I always tell them just to Google it or call IUPUI. What is it?
There's a telephone number. I think it is 278-7600. And it's IUPUI Continuing Studies.
That's probably the easiest way.
Yeah.
If they don't remember that, Google IUPUI Continuing Studies. You could get a number. Somebody will be able to hook you up with when Donald's class is going to be.
It's four Tuesday nights in October.
October.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I apologize. I rambled too long. So Chester, hang on. It'll be up first. And any others that have something for Donald, 317-239-1070. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley Brickyard Edition from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Coverage all day tomorrow here from IMS. And I called in JMV an hour earlier. 11 a.m. Sunday is when coverage begins. So John and the rest do not need to be here until 11. They're on, I think, from 11 until 2:30, and then that's when network coverage takes over, and the green flag is at about 3:45 Sunday afternoon for the Crown Royal presents the Jeff Kyle 400 at the Brickyard. Heard exclusively here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. I'm Kevin Lee, 317-239-1070. Chester is up first with Donald Davidson. Hi, Chester.
Hello.
Hey, Donald. Pretty good. Listen, everybody knows about the Unsers and how well they did in IndyCar. Did any of the Unsers run in either Grand National or stock car events, and how did they do?
Yes. Jerry Unser only ever ran USAC stock cars, but Al, Bobby, and Al Jr. all did. Al ran, no, are we saying NASCAR only or all stock cars? Okay, I think he did mention Grand National or... which actually Grand National used to be the main series. Anyway, they ran USAC quite a bit, or at least Al and Bobby did. Al Jr. never ran a USAC stock car, but he did drive in the Daytona 500 in 1993. And I remember that, here we go with a personal story. And I remember that at the time that the Race for Heroes series was being done, which was actually 88-89, and when Ari Leyendyke won the 500, we did another show, and then when Al Jr. won in 92, we went to Albuquerque and spent some time with him. Anyway, when we got there, he said, and this would have been at the end of the season, so in fact later than that, this would have been like early December of 1992. And he said, guess what? He said, I just got a phone call, and I'm going to do Daytona. And we just assumed he meant the Daytona 24 Hours. And mm-hmm. he said, no, I'm going to drive the Daytona 500. And I think, was he an Earnhardt teammate? I know he did get tapped by Earnhardt, and I think he was a teammate, but it was a Valvoline-sponsored stock car. But anyway, that was his only start in the Daytona 500. And I'm not – oh, it was – okay, somebody's saying Rick Hendricks? I think that might have been his only NASCAR race, period. And then Al had just a handful. He went to the Daytona 500 in 1968, I think it was, and he finished fourth. Could have been 69. Got to think about that. Because he actually he ran USAC for Rudy Hare and for several years, but he went down and he ran the one Daytona 500. I think it was 1968. Anyway, he finished fourth, and he never went back.
Wow.
And I don't recall if it was Rudy Hare that he drove for at Daytona. He did run a couple of races after that for Cotton Owens. And why he never went back, I have no idea. I mean, to go down there and finish fourth, you'd think you'd be encouraged to do more. Now, Bobby ran a few more, but again, he ran a lot of USAC stock car races, but he did the Daytona 500 probably three times. And I'm thinking about one of his starts may have been for Smokey Yunick, but I can't say that for sure. And then I think he ran the K&K Dodge Nord Krauskopf from Fort Wayne in USAC and may be in NASCAR as well. And then I'm trying to think whether Bobby may have run the Riverside 500. Anyway, I'm a little sketchy. I guess I'm going to have to brush up on that a little bit.
You got homework.
Yeah, I got some homework.
That's all right. Close enough.
Yeah, but in USAC extensively, but... Yep, I don't think I'm missing anything. All right.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you, Chester. Paul and Racine is up next with Donald Davidson. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hey, Donald. Hey, Kevin. How are you guys tonight?
We're great. Just fine. Thank you.
Good, good. Hey, I got a little background noise. Sorry about that. But Donald, could you profile Joe Quinn, former safety director?
Joe Quinn was... from Terre Haute. I think he was, if not born there, he lived most of his life in Terre Haute, and was part of the Tony Holman close advisor. I think he was, I don't remember what his position, but he worked for the Terre Haute Gas Company, and in those days, for the first many years. After the war, in fact, throughout the whole Tony Holman existence, life was very different. The Indianapolis Motor Speedway staff throughout the year was not that big, except for maintenance. In fact, I think that we one time figured out that even up through late 70s and around 1980, you had the 500 only. And tire tests, you just had the one race. Mm-hmm. And so...
And you didn't have to do a lot of marketing.
No, they sold itself. The newspapers did it for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, that's a whole nother story, which I don't know if I should get into now. But until 1965, you had three locally owned newspapers. And then when the time stopped, you still had the two. And the news... And the Star, the coverage was phenomenal, and virtually everybody on the staff was from here, and or Central Indiana at least. Mm-hmm. And the same with radio and TV. And I know a number of people have probably already heard me say this at talks because I kind of maybe belabor the point a little bit. But when I first came to the area, you turned on the TV to watch the local news, and your anchor probably went through the Indianapolis school system. And so did most of the people, the weather guy and everybody. They were all from Central Indiana.
I think that's the way our society has changed. Yeah. I think, I don't know when it started, what age group we're talking about, but an awful lot of people you meet, and no matter what city you're in, there's a decent percentage that is not from that city. Yeah. And a lot of people have moved to three or four different places. And obviously, some cities are more transient than others. You know, Atlanta is a city that comes up where no one seems to really to be from there. But it certainly was that way in Indianapolis back in the day.
When I showed
up.
And
I suspect it was more that way around the country back in the day.
Probably,
you could speak to that better than I could.
Well, my thinking was that you know, you went to the Star or the News, and you went up and down the halls, and almost everybody you ran into was a Hoosier. And radio and TV, same.
Well, when I was a kid, the same people would anchor the newscast for 15 or 20 years.
Right.
Nothing ever changed.
That started to change in the late 60s. It was around 69, 70, 71. Then you started to see fresh faces. Who's that? Well, they came from Denver or Phoenix or whatever it is. And sometimes they would stay. Like Bob Gregory is not a Hoosier, but he became an adopted Hoosier. But then you also had a lot of people that they would do 2 years or whatever it was, and then they would move on. They fell out of favor, or a consulting company said, you know, you need to, whatever it was, and so the whole business changed, and it's got nothing to do with Joe Quinn, but
we'll get back there eventually.
But we'll get back there eventually. But the fact is that PR was very different in those days. I mean, I had this conversation with Tom Serber, who, you know, yesterday driving over to Pittsburgh.
Is our audience to note there are still three people in the very back of the room, and Tom is up at the front.
when we were going to Pittsburgh, and we were talking about Al Blemker as the director of publicity for the Indianapolis Speedway, and I said, you know, you had. The sports editor for the Star, sports editor for the News, and basically there would be like a half a dozen of them, and they all, you know, most people smoked, and you would enjoy a drink of an eve, and they would get together and play cards, and that's how a lot of the PR was done, that your media grew up with the track anyway. I mean, if the sports department, if you had eight people in there, you'd have a stick and ball guy, but most of them, you had, you know, you had 75-80% of your staff could easily just sit down and do a racing story, no problem at all.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm kind of off the subject a little bit, except Joe Quinn knew how that worked, and so.
And he was the safety director?
He was the safety director. Okay. Oh, I know where I was going, was the fact that when the 500 was over, for most of the summer and through the winter, the full-time staff at the Indianapolis Speedway was about 18 people, other than for maintenance. And then in the spring, shortly after the first of the year, and the entries went out, and we used to, you know, get the press releases were coming out every two or three days about the latest entries that were coming, and we don't do that anymore. But anyway, more and more people would come over from Terre Haute, and the staff would build up at the track, but they weren't Indianapolis Motor Speedway employees. They were Holman & Company employees.
Okay.
And they would simply move. We'd go wherever Tony needs us to go. And so Joe Quinn was one of Tony's, you know, henchmen, for want of a better term. And no sooner had the track been purchased than they started to go around central Indiana to get support for the event, and they would go to the Lions clubs and you know, all the service organizations and the Chamber of Commerce and forgive the little dig here, but it was almost exclusively men, cigars and men, and so they would go and just say, you know, we're getting the track going again, and we would really appreciate any support you boys could give us. and I remember.
And I'll pick up the tab tonight.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Joe Quinn knew a lot of the politicians, and he was very good about, you know, to get support. So, in fact, I remember. Oh, golly, this was probably late 80s, early 90s. And I drove over to Crawfordsville to give a talk. And I get off the freeway, and I'm driving into town, and to my astonishment, there was a huge olive drab colored banner about, you know, 3-4 blocks from the city center, from the town center, to say Indianapolis 500 mile race, and it had the qualifying dates and the race date, and it was worn and faded, except that the qualifying dates and the race date were brand new because they'd just been painted again. Uh-huh. And when I went to give the talk, and I think it was the Shriners, and I said, tell me about the sign. And they said, well, we do that every year. But who makes that happen? Because I don't, you know, Joe Quinn used to go through, and Tony would go, and they'd speak to the locals, and probably paid for those signs. And now they were both long gone, and these guys every spring would get the ladders out and climb up and put up the banners. And I thought, up at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway doesn't even know about this. But anyway, I am off on another tangent. But Joe Quinn did a great deal to promote the race and get the politicians involved. And he also was the promoter of the Hoosier 100 because the fairgrounds, I think that there's something was that the fairgrounds, the fair board could not promote the race. They had to have a promoter of title. And so Joe Quinn did that for years, and he was a great promoter. And he would sell the Hoosier 100 by going down whining and dining the newspaper guys, and instead of having one PA announcer, he would have probably six PA announcers, but it would be all the radio and TV stations. He'd get everybody involved.
Smart.
And then he would invite people to write a story for the program and pay them $25 or whatever it was. And then finally, when his tenure out there ended, then Don Smith came in pretty much under the same circumstances. But Joe Quinn was a very colorful character, and he wore this vest that was almost like the Michael J. Fox vest in Back to the Future. It was a big red, and everybody just thought, well, he's so flamboyant, he's doing that to show off. Well, in fact, he had a very low blood temperature. I don't know if I explained it very well, but even on a hot day, he had to wear that sort of thermal vest in order to keep the body temperature up. Hmm. But he was quite a character. And so I probably ran on a little long and went off into some areas and probably offended a few people, and I hope I did.
No, anyway, we're all good. Paul, thanks for the call. More thanks, questions Paul. For Donald. We have wide open phone lines now. Jump on board. 317-239-1070 on the radio. This is, I think, your last chance to call in and talk to Donald until we get that internet show up and running for you until next May. So I would highly suggest you take
next
advantage.
May.
Unless Donald comes back for MotoGP.
No, I don't think we're doing it. I would, but I don't think there's any plans to do a MotoGP show.
I don't believe there is either.
No.
I don't think I'll be here either for that one. So call in now. It's your chance to talk with Donald at 239-1070 on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. It's the Talking Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. At the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, I'm Kevin Lee. Back to the phones. We still have an open line or two at 317-239-1070. Kent is up next with Donald.
Hello.
Yeah, hello, everybody. Donald, I was part of the original Telex crew back in 92 when we ran camera for the original practice down here. And we were talking about that, a couple of guys, we were talking about that today at the track, and we couldn't remember how many people how many of the drivers participated. We were thinking 9, and I was thinking like 12, because I have a credential which, after the thing was over with, a lot of the drivers signed, and I've got 7 names on there, and I was thinking there was 9 because I didn't get Ernie Irvin's, and I think John Andretti ran too, didn't he?
He did, and I don't remember if it was 9 or 12, but I know that what they did was They ran as individuals, and then they did a mock race to see what it would be like to run a bunch of them together. And John Andretti was brand new on the scene in that form of competition. And I think he was up at the front, and he spun and took out the whole field.
Wow.
or close to it. John, sorry, but I was thinking, oh, no. But so
Wasn't
I can't tell
you. Somebody else's car?
I don't remember
why. One of the other guys said he thought he was driving somebody else's car because he couldn't make it in for the test because they came from Michigan, correct? Sunday before?
Yes, I think. Now, I don't know if that was the first one, which was sort of like the feasibility one, but I know that there was a test that was right after Michigan. It was going to be like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday or something, and they ran Michigan.
Yeah, this is in 92.
But I don't remember if this was the first one or the first big one, but I know that they had this one where they still were, and this is back to like the earlier point and the end of your the end of the last show that you did with Kurt on all of the interest that was built up by the first what eventually became a Brickyard 400, they had this test here, and the fans knew that the haulers were going to be coming down from Michigan, and so the haulers started arriving like at 10 o'clock at night, and they're coming down. And then along 16th to go to Tunnel 2, and there was all these fans waving at them, and they're the truck drivers showing up for a test.
Wow.
And when they thought, you know what, I think we may have something going here.
That might be one where Bill Jr. would have said, I think we've arrived.
Yeah. But the accident with poor John, I think that might have been a Goodyear test. And I think Rusty Wallace was involved in that, too. But
So the one I'm thinking of, or we see the footage from, that was not the first test. Well, help me with this. Was the first time a stock car tested here in that 92 era, was that a little more in secret and there were not a lot of people? Was that less publicized and there were very few, if any, fans outside?
That's the one with John, I think. And then,
because I've never heard of, I did not know that story, and I don't think there's footage available of that, is there?
No. But although I'm sure I was watching it on a monitor.
Oh, okay.
And then you thought, oh, no. But then they had at least two with a lot of cars.
Yeah, there was one where Petty was in, right?
Well, that would have been 92 because he was still running.
Yeah.
And then, in fact, I think that's when he donated the car. He did the run and then donated the car to the museum, which I think is on the floor right now, as a matter of fact. But as far as NASCAR testing cars here, actually – it went way back.
You mentioned that the other day.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did the 24-hour run, but there was another one. In fact, this was funny. Somebody said to me one time, probably 3-4 years ago, they said, I've got a photograph of Buck Baker in a Pontiac stock car at the Speedway. I said, oh, not Buck Baker. I said, you mean Fireball Roberts or Joe Weatherly? He said, no, Buck Baker. I said, no, Buck Baker never ran at the track. To my knowledge, and he said, I got a photograph of it. And so anyway, he bought the photograph of it, and sure enough, it's Buck Baker in a stock car. And so I looked at some of the other people in the shot, and there was Ronnie Householder, who was the head of Chrysler at that time, or Chrysler in motorsports. I remember Bruce Jacoby was standing in the shot with his arm in a sling, so that put it to, I think, 1962, because he just had an accident. And Bob Cassidy was worked for Firestone Racing Division at that time. And so I called Bob, and I said, do you remember this run? And he said, no, I don't. And so he came over. I showed him the photograph, and he said, I don't remember this at all. I said, well, that's you standing in the shot. But anyway, that was like an early feasibility run. So they were looking at coming here way before they ever did. I don't know if any of that makes any sense.
It does. It does. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Kent. Good question. Jimmy is next on the west side of Indianapolis. Hello, Jimmy. You're on with Donald Davidson.
Oh, by the way, before we get to Jimmy, I was going to, the last caller, he said he worked for Telex, and I haven't geared into exactly who I was talking to, but it would be somebody I know.
Probably.
Yeah, so if he would call me back privately, I'm probably somebody I need to catch up with. All right, Jimmy, go ahead.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. This next May is going to be my dad's 70th consecutive 500.
Wow.
Attended, yeah. And I was just wondering if you were familiar with any statistics as far as, like, individual fan attendance, or even if you've just heard stories, if you might know where that would stack up. Like,
well,
are there a lot of people who have that many, or...
Well, no.
Cannot be very many.
One thing is, many of the listeners have heard me make this comment for quite a number of years now. When somebody will come up and say, I've been going for 28 years, or my dad's gone for 36 years, or whatever it was, how does that stack up? And I said, I would say that for many years I have felt that probably half the crowd for the 500, probably 40 years, is 35 to 40 years is probably average. I mean, there's a lot of people that have been going for that many. Now, when it goes beyond that, then obviously it thins out. And the real break-off point, if you like, is World War II. Now, Bill Marvel, I think, has been to every 500 since either 40 or 41.
Wow.
And I would say that there are probably not very many people. Now, 70, I'd have to figure back when his first year would be, because that goes up. That's back to the late 30s. So I would say that the number of people that go back to 41 or earlier, there can't be very many of those.
Well, 70 would be...
Well,
is that 1947 would have been his first?
I can't even do that off the top of my head.
I think Jimmy dropped off.
All right, then. I
was told there'd be no math, Donald.
70 seems like it would go back to the 30s, but maybe
no,
not.
Isn't 45? Isn't 45 plus 70 115?
Okay, Jimmy. Yes. Do you know what year your dad went for the first time?
I thought it was 47.
Yeah.
Okay then.
Okay.
Well then I would say that I think there are probably a small percentage that have either been every year since 46 or went to 46 and maybe dropped off at some point. But I do know, as I say, I do know Bill Marvel, I think, went from in 40 or 41, and then I don't think he missed any unless it was because of the military.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so as far as him having, if the 70th 500, that's pretty rare.
And I'm impressed by not just 70, but 70 consecutive without ever missing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing, because I've run into a lot of people that said, well, I've done 58 or 61 or whatever it was, and normally the military was when they had to miss a
sure.
year or two.
My sister and I had thought maybe the Speedway could do something like say his name on the PA or something next year. And people we've asked have said, well, if they do that for him, they'd have to do it for everybody who's been there 70 times in a row. And I thought, well, geez,
there
can
can't
really
be many
that
of
many?
Those.
Yeah. Well, I got to think 70, we ought to have time to be able to fit that in. There can't be more than a dozen or so. So.
Well, I know that in recent years that they've tried to do stuff like that to recognize. In fact, I even noticed in the Brickyard 400 program that there's like about four or five pages of names of people, and I didn't stop to see what the criteria was, if that's people that have been to every Brickyard 400, but they
You've
have
been to all of those too.
Okay. Oh, really? Okay, then. So then that's 92, then.
Yeah.
Is it?
There you go.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I know that the IMS management and PR would be interested in that.
All right. Okay, stay with us. More questions for Donald. Coming up, it's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Talk of Gasoline Alley continues, FM 107.5, 1070 The Fan with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Our friend Josh Laycock texts me and says Bill Marvel, since 1941, has attended every 500. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he said, my dad, every race since 1946, and the local ABC did a feature on both of them race morning this year.
So his dad is Bob Laycock Jr.
Yeah, good information there. Back to something we talked about last night. We had a question about the Dan Weldon chassis that won the 2011 500, and Stephen Kilstonk on Twitter says that was a 2003 chassis, number 7 for Panther, then later Fernandez, Roth, Fast, which
Marty
was Alex
Roth.
Tagliani's team, and then Schmidt. And that does ring a bell. I remember hearing that Marty Roth's car eventually, a lot of the equipment was bought by the Fast team, which became the Sam Schmidt team. And, you know, this is my own tangent. I've been learning from you. But that's what we remember always saying is that Marty Roth has good equipment. I wish he would just hire a driver.
I know.
Because that would be a good team, and he's got all kinds of cash. Those are the kinds of owners that you need.
I remember.
But he wanted to drive.
He had a hauler. Yeah. That you thought, wow, look at that.
Marty was well-funded.
Yeah.
All right. 239-1070 is our telephone number. Who did I leave on hold, David? Steve, you are up next with Donald Davidson.
I got a little trivia on Marty Roth, by the way, but let's talk to Steve.
Okay.
Yeah, Donald. I was listening to Kurt and Kevin. They were talking about Dale Jarrett. His greatest moment was winning the Brickyard.
Yeah.
And I've noticed the last few years, the winner of the 500, even the fans have insisted they kiss the bricks. And I think that was a tradition started by Dale Jarrett after his first win, wasn't it?
Oh, the kissing of the bricks, yes. That was 1996. And Dale Jarrett and Todd Parrott, the crew chief, went out and dropped to their knees and kissed the bricks. And apparently that's something that they had talked about that they might do. But other than that, it wasn't planned, just
wasn't
between the two of them.
Todd Parrott's idea more? Doesn't
probably,
Dale give
yes.
him credit for that?
I don't know. But it was between the two of them. And there is a photograph to record that up in the photo library. But I think there's only one shot that's taken from sort of somebody was standing over them as they were they're going down. And so
that's more than the hat dance, the coordinating everything down there.
But it almost got lost because and there's another thing that some people have heard me say a number of times, and that is I'm fascinated by traditions and how they get started or how they don't. And if you try to create a tradition, it probably won't happen. What takes off? Something that you never even thought about.
Yep.
So most of the great traditions here and I'm sure other places just happen by accident. And so anyway, whether it was Todd Parrott's idea, but the two of them went out, and we have the one photograph of the two of them. So the next year, then Ricky Rudd went out and did it, and I don't know how many different versions of it, but within 2, 3, 4, 5 years, then it became, now it's an orchestrated production, and there's like 100 photographers out there. And I don't know, it's like the hat dance, as you said. I don't know how many different versions that there are, but, you know, somebody's calling the shots. All right, driver and crew chief. All right, driver and mother and father. You know, driver and family. Driver and all the over the wall.
And now they have
driver and the truck driver.
They have custom Crown Royal pillows down
yes,
there.
Yes, that's right. I forgot about that. And I know there's one where they have like, you know, 30 or 40 people. It's all of the support guys. All right, everybody, 1, 2, 3. Yes, and they all get. But yes, it just started by accident. Absolutely, Dale Jarrett and Todd Parrott.
Boy, you're right. That is the best way for a tradition to happen. You can have all the planning and marketing meetings that you want and think this is a great idea, but it works best when it's organic and it just happens. And if it's good, then people will pick up on it and say, I like that. I want to see that happen again.
Who
knows if, you know, Elio Castroneves, the first time he climbed the fence, probably was simply spontaneous. And it still works, but it works because no one said, hey, what can we do to celebrate? And just in the emotion of his first IndyCar win, I believe it was at Detroit.
Somewhere. It was a road course.
I believe it was Detroit is where he climbed the fence in, what would that have been, 2000? I think it was, and that not only became his signature, but a lot of others have took on that as well. I guess Tony Stewart is the one that comes to mind that's tried to climb the fence before.
Right. In fact, I don't know. I think Dan Weldon climbed the fence, I think. 500 winner. Tony Stewart's done it, but I think other 500 winners, I don't know. I'm getting almost over. Because what I was going to say was I don't think I'll have time for this thought. There's no shows till next May? No, I'm not going home. Poopy. I want to do a show.
Well,
thanks, everybody, for calling in.
Chances
really
that we
can
continue that thought in May? Probably not, but I'm sure it'll come to us again at some point. Well, Donald, as always, it has been a pleasure. I invite people to join you for your class. Is it still at Speedway High School?
It is, yes.
Okay, coming up in October, and look into that from the Continuing Education Program at IUPUI. Gates open at 7 tomorrow, Xfinity qualifying at 11:35, Cup qualifying at 1 o'clock. You'll hear that here on 1070 The Fan. The Xfinity race comes up at 3:45. Coverage begins here from IMS tomorrow at 11:30. It includes our studio producer, David Deering, with the producers and coverage all day long and evening. And I'll be back after the Xfinity race tomorrow night. And then Sunday morning, coverage begins at 11. For Donald and David, I'm Kevin Lee. Thanks for joining us on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.